This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
A miraculous relationship, and the other is a hanaga tivit, a natural relationship. And they require different responses from us, so it's important to understand them both. But the first problem that I want to raise in connection with these two ways of relating, of the Ribbono Shel Olam relating to us, is on the basis of what we established last week, that there's nothing more miraculous about splitting the Red Sea than about a bee making honey. In that case, what is really the difference between Hanaga Nisik and Hanaga Tzivit? The only difference seems to be that that nature is miracles which we've taken for granted. They're miracles which happen every day. And if the splitting of the Red Sea happened every day, imagine if every day at 4 o'clock the Red Sea split, it would be nature, it wouldn't be no big thing. The only thing that makes it special is because it only happens once. If the bee had only made honey once, can you imagine if it was reported in the Torah that 4,000 years ago a little bee came around and he sat on a little flower for 10 minutes, and then a whole lot of other bees came and each one sat on a flower, and then they went into a little box and they made this pattern out of wax, a perfect hexagonal little cells, and they filled it up with the most sweet tasting material that was unbelievably sweet and beautiful, and that was the only time, and it was put into a little jar and kept for generations, but we don't have it today. Imagine if that was written in the Torah. We would talk about this incredible, the miracle of the bees, like the moon. That's because it happens every day, we take it for granted. So what really is the difference between Hanhaga Nisit and Hanhaga Tivit, when God chooses to relate to us on the basis of a miraculous existence? Is it really any different to when he chooses to relate to us naturally? When he split the Red Sea, was it a different relationship to today, or was it the same relationship as today? So to understand these two relationships, one has to look into this. Picture the scene where Miriam has just died. Miriam was very close to Moshe and Aaron. So they said in Shiva, obviously. So they go into the Olam Moed, they go into the little Mishkan there, and the two of them are sitting Shiva, sitting on the ground, eating their hard-boiled eggs or whatever it is, and feeling very upset for the loss of Miriam. They've gone through a rough time. Moshe is an old man, nearing the age of 120 at this stage. He's about 119. His last years of intended retirement were the most hectic of his life. From the period of 80, his career began at 80, and it was no easy career. Starting to get the Jews out of Egypt and getting no thanks for that, and the war after war and trouble after trouble, and the difficulties and the teaching that had to be done, and the Mesiras Nefesh to get the Torah, and the breaking of the first tablet of stone, and his disappointment at seeing the level to which the Am Yisrael had fallen, and so on and so forth. He'd had a very difficult 40 years, apart from his earlier life when he grew up without a mother and father in the house of Pharaoh, and he had to run for his life. And Trevor's story about looking for situations that are to get the best out of you, Moshe's life is a supreme example from the day he was born. Now his sister's died. One Torah after another. He hasn't had an easy life by any means. He's sitting there with Aaron, and they're talking about it, and there's a noise outside. It's going up. They look out of the window, thousands of people. And the Medrash reports that Moshe says to Aaron, "What's going out outside? What's going on outside there?" And Aaron says, "Don't say it in that tone of voice, as if they're coming to give you trouble. Obviously, they've heard about Miriam, and they've come to be Menachem Ovel. They find people, these Jews, and you shouldn't get angry with them. And obviously, they've come to commiserate with us and to comfort us." So Moshe takes another look out of the window. Aaron was the one full of kindness, but Moshe was the one with the perception. And he says, "If this was an official delegation to come and comfort us, the police would have been at the head. The judges and the heads of the community would have been leading the delegation. This is the rabble. The leaders of the community aren't here. It's the masses. This is a demonstration." So they let the people in. What's it? Water. The water supply has gone off. The king of Israel, the rov of the community of millions of people, is busy sitting Shiva. And there they come. The water's coming. We've got to worry about that also. And then they start a whole big business. Why did you, would it be better to die in the desert? Okay. Why did you bring the community of God to this miserable place to die here? And why did you take us out of Egypt altogether? This is the strange part. Why did you take us out of Egypt altogether to bring us to this land to this place, which is not a place that you can grow anything, never mind figs and grapes and pomegranates, and there's no water, there's absolutely nothing. And Moshe and Aaron don't know what to do, and they come into the Ohel Moed, and God appears. And God says, don't worry, take your stick, and get the people together, you and Aaron, get the people together at the rock. This was the rock. It was the rock that had come with them all the way. This is the well of Miriam, which had now run dry. And talk to the rock in front of everybody, and it will give water. So Moshe takes the rock with the stick, as he was commanded, gets the people together, him and Aaron, at the face of the rock, and he says, listen now, you rebellious ones, do you expect me to get water out of this rock? And he lifts up his stick and he hits the rock once, and he hits it again, and the water comes up. That's the story of the Meribah. The first question is, what is their complaint about? What did you bring us to this miserable place where you can't plant anything? They know that's not Israel. It's another year to go, less than a year, and they're going to be there. They're on the borders of Israel already. This is no time to complain about it. For 39 years they've gone through this, and they've put up with it more or less. Everything's been alright, they've survived. They know that the desert isn't the end, but it's only the means of getting to the end. All of a sudden they start talking to Moshe as if this is the end and they've been let down. This is Israel. Of course this isn't Israel. This is the desert, and we know conditions are tough. But bear with us for another couple of months and you'll be in Israel. They say, no, you brought us to this miserable place, and it's not only land flowing with milk and honey, and there are no figs, and there are no pomegranates, it's not even water. I don't live there for good. That's the first question. Second question is, God tells them to go and speak to the rock. Ever seen a rock with ears? Well, what's it going to help speaking to rocks? You cry. Speaking to trees and flowers. There's a place for a theory that should help. But to speak to rocks to get water, there's no basis for that. And if it's going to be a miracle, then he's got the stick. Why doesn't he do it the same as he did all the other miracles? And if he's not going to use the stick, why was he told to take the stick? The whole thing is very difficult. And then he finally uses the stick. He doesn't talk, he uses the stick, and he's punished. What is God punishing for? Yan lo he'emantim bi, you didn't believe me. You didn't believe in me. Why not? Didn't God, Moshe show a lack of emunah? You didn't sanctify my name in front of the Bnei Israel. Therefore you will not bring the people of Israel to the land which I've given to them. Such a punishment. After those 40 miserable years where the only thing that must have kept this old man going was the fact that he'll have the nachas and the pleasure of getting them into Israel ultimately and seeing them settled before he dies. Now he's told even that he won't get. For what? Because he didn't believe in God. Of course he believed in God, because he hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock. Okay, so he hit it instead of speaking. It's no less of a miracle. In fact, last time when he had a similar problem, he was told to hit the rock. They did it the same as last time. Secondly, what is Aaron going to do with it all? Aaron didn't hit the rock. Why is Aaron punished the same way? That's a difficult passage. On this business of talking to the rock, the Medrash says in the Yalkut Shimon is something which is doesn't make it any easier. But the Medrash obviously has the same problem. The Dibartem of Asela. It doesn't say you must hit the rock. The Torah is specific in talking to the rock. Obviously the Medrash is worried, what does it help talking to a rock? Answers the Medrash. Omalei, God said to Moshe, this is a lesson in education. Kishehanar katan, when a kid is small, rabo makehu melando, his teacher must hit him to teach him. These parents who think that to pride themselves of never having hit their children, maybe there's something to pride themselves about, but they have the patience that the children are going to suffer for it. That you educate by hitting you, that the child has to experience certain hardship and suffering in order to understand and to feel that there are certain things which are not permitted. Once the child's older, you don't have to hit the child anymore. Then you can punish the child, you can cause equal suffering by sharp words. That's what God says to Moshe. When this rock was a little rock some time ago, 40 years ago, then you were right, I told you to hit the rock. I told you, and you shall hit the rock. But now that it's a big rock, talk to it. And look what the Midrash goes on to say. Learn over the rock a piece of Gemara. Water will come up. So the Medrash is answering, it doesn't mean talk to the rock. It really means learn at the rock. And that will do it. Very difficult. Let's see the thing in its perspective. We've had the situation where, starting 3 weeks ago, at Shlach Lecha, at Bahalotecha, we already pointed out that Moshe was the only person, not even his Talmud Yehoshua, could love properly. There was a problem when it came to Yehoshua releasing love for somebody else who was a rising star in the community. Yehoshua felt threatened, and he felt that Moshe should stop this rebellion. Moshe was the one who said, Arabai, everybody should be so bright. Then the next week we had Shlach Lecha, the sending the spies. We found that the whole problem with the Jews in wanting to send the spies was a lack of Ahava. They didn't love the Ribbono Shel Olam sufficiently to be motivated by that love. They had to see it visually. Last week, they're taking everything for granted. Korach, we discussed it. Moshe, why do you have to be the teacher, the leader over here? Give someone else a chance. Democratic society, we should have chairmanship by rotation. We asked, how is it possible that Korach could say after Moshe what he'd done for them? He'd say, in what way are you different from everybody else? Because that's basically what he's saying. We're all equal. You're no special. Why are you and your family on top all the time? Give someone else a chance. We discussed that it was taken for granted. And we asked, how is it possible that people like this are taken for granted? How does one reach that level? And he said that Mekablin, people who are recipients, who are always receiving, take for granted. And this is a generation that grew up in with miraculous Hanagani Sit, with a relationship of miracles. And that doesn't bring about the development of love. You develop love out of giving, not out of receiving. A parent loves his child much more than the child loves the parent. Because the parent, the child receives, the parent gives. And the more tzoros, the more tzar gidul bonim there is, the more pain and suffering that goes into raising a child, the stronger is the love of the parent for the child. But it doesn't help the love of the child for the parent. So the Ribbono Shel Olam has to decide now what to do about this. It's come to the stage where something has to be done. There were a couple of scenes in this film, The Holocaust, which were good. And one is the very last scene. The very last scene is this kid who left his home about 1938 as a kid of about 17 because he saw what was happening and he decided to get out of Berlin. And you live through the long hours of the film. Is that where you got the idea of doing this in two sessions? You live through his experiences at various other people. You go through, he sees everything. He goes through, he suffers, and he gets married, and his wife is killed. And he goes on and on. Right, he sees the gory details of the war, and he battles and battles and battles just to stay alive. Trevor was describing a situation without vanity. What was this boy? There was absolutely no comfort to his life. There was nothing more than essentials to his life. Is that Eliyahu not becoming? Everybody looks, a person comes in, you would think Eliyahu is just saying, you're busy hearing Torah. The Torah, you stop hearing Torah to look at someone. Curiosity to see someone come in is more than the curiosity for Torah. And I'm sure when Eliyahu comes in, nobody will even bat an eyelid. You live through all this with him, and then when the war is over, he starts making his way. He's basically run back to the Eastern Front, and he's gone right through Russia. And now he starts coming back as he feels that the things are getting better and that Russia has progressed more towards Germany. He moves back and he starts coming across the remnants of the concentration camps, and he sees what actually happened, and he goes through and the tzoros that his family went through, which he only finds out about later on. At the very end of the last scene, there's the liberation of the concentration camp in which his sister-in-law was kept. His sister-in-law was not Jewish. And he meets her there. There's the emotional meeting. And she says to him, do you hate me for it? You know, I wouldn't be upset if you felt I was one of them and you hated me. He said, no, I don't hate you. I don't love you either. I don't feel hate or love. I feel nothing. And you realize then the problem of the people who had come through the concentration camps, their inability to feel. Because you couldn't survive that. back to the whole thing with Trevor had discussed. Unless you either were a saint, a tzaddik, or you just became insensitive. Viktor Frankl's second stage, the apathy. And having lived with that apathy for years and seeing the atrocities that one sees, often with love and hate on just feelings that you can't build up in you. And then he walks over to the side of the road and he looks down, there's a soccer field and the little kids playing soccer. He watches these kids playing soccer. His first experience of anti-Semitism was on a soccer field in Berlin as a child at school. You see him watching these kids playing soccer. And another Jew comes over to him and says, "We know all about you and how you survived the war. We've got a job for you." He says, "What?" "Because those kids down there are Greek children whose parents were massacred. We want to smuggle them into Israel. We want you to do it." He says he doesn't think he's qualified and so on. And at that, he jumps over the wall and he runs downstairs and he gets to the children and he starts playing soccer with them. And the movie ends with a picture of exhilaration and love as he whips one of the kids up and he runs with one of the children. And at first it looks unreal, this change in one moment from a young man who says, "I can't feel love and hate," to a face filled with love. It seems a little bit unreal. And yet one realizes that for that kid, that was the miracle of the war. The fact that immediately it was over, he was given a challenge and a responsibility to others, is something which enabled him again to love. And when I thought afterwards about people who have gone through the war, and my big question is how they've remained sane, not how they survived, but how they remained sane, how they came out sane. If one looks at those who did come out sane, it was people who immediately after the war were faced with a challenge. Marriage, found children, or took in adopted children, fought for Israel, worked for a Zionist cause. Those people who worked through and immediately after the war took up a challenge and were able to dive into that are people who today can love and hate. And those who didn't are people who today can't love and hate. They don't have the capacity. So the problem of the Jew coming out of the concentration camp in 1945 was the same as the Ribbono Shel Olam's problem then. And it's not strange that it should have been the same, right? Apart from what we've seen, these people were lacking in love and in the ability to love, which is the problem we've identified over the last 3 weeks. It's not strange they've come out of 300 years of concentration camp, 200 years of concentration camp. You know, we worry about the Holocaust and we have a special memorial day for it and all that kind of thing. Pesach's not so important, but the Yom HaZikaron, that's a day that everybody has to take very seriously. Sure, it's a serious thing, but Pesach is just as serious. There were more people involved. No, not true. More generations involved. At a much more critical stage of Jewish history. And the suffering was greater, if one can imagine that. Mitzrayim was a concentration camp. And these are ex-concentration inmates. A couple of years after liberation. What is the problem? Inability to love. Not the Ribbono Shel Olam, not people, not anybody. They can't love. And we've seen that all the difficulties over the last 3 weeks have been difficulties that have stemmed from this inability to love. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, they've got to smuggle Jews into Israel. They have to have a challenge immediately. Initially the idea was that straight after liberation they would be faced with the challenge of conquest of Israel. But that was changed because of the chet of the Egel. They were given 40 years in the desert. Because of the Meraglim. They were given 40 years in the desert, which meant that they now were lacking this challenge. And they had you had the same raw material coming out of Egypt without the immediate challenge, living miraculously. Every day the mon comes down and the water's there and whatever they need is there. They're sitting and learning and everything's wonderful. There's no need to love. They're managing very fine without loving. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, we've got to stop changing this. First thing he does is he turns off the water. Let's see what they do when they've got no water. And that's the parsha as it stands here. This is a turning point. This parsha, Parsha's Chukat, is a turning point in the whole story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of the period from the concentration camp, from Mitzrayim, to the settlement of Eretz Israel. He turns off the water, the obvious happens. They run to Moshe, we've got no water. no consideration that Moshe is an Ovel, no consideration that Moshe has other things to do at the moment. Nothing. No water, run to Moshe. Before they even think of what we can do, they didn't try to dig wells, they didn't go looking for water, nothing. First thing is no water, let's go to Moshe. What does God tell Moshe? Get them to the rock. They're going to work now. Last time you hit the rock and the water came out. It's not going to work like that this time. They're going to get the water out of the rock. Kikalu etaydan, that's why he's told. Kach etamate, take your stick, v'hakel etayda, atam v'aron achicha. You and Aaron, gather the community together. V'dibatim el ha-sela l'eineihem. Says the Medrash, what does it mean if you talk to the sela? Give a shir at the rock. And then let them daven after the shir. If they daven well, there'll be water. If they won't daven well, there won't be water. That's their business now. Hand it over to them. They've got to start getting used to living in Israel. And living in Israel is not like living in Egypt or living in the desert. There you've got to dig for your water. And if there's no water after digging, you've got to pray for your water. And that's the only thing you can get. And Chazal actually tell us that one of the aspects of Eretz Israel is that it has no natural water sources. It's totally dependent on rainfall. And if it doesn't rain, you're in trouble. And they've got to know what to do when it doesn't rain. What do? You're driving for it. No running to Moshe. Moshe, you're about to die. They've got to learn to live without you. That's how the Netziv learns it. But what they were told, and this is clear from the Medrash over here, the Dibartem el Aseva, what does it mean? Shana alav perek echad. You learn a Masechta, you learn a bit of Gemara at the rock. And then the water will come, provided the people are stimulated through your shir to daven properly. The Netziv learns it that way. What's the purpose of taking the rock? Well, let's look at it this way. The rock, this portable well that used to come with him, is now a part of nature. What's the difference? We started off by saying that nature and miracles is only a question of regularity. So this to them is nature. In the desert, how do you get water? From your portable rock. There's no rain, there are no rivers, you have a portable rock, and that brings the water. And the same as we take honey and milk for granted, and we take rain and hail and snow for granted, they took their portable rock for granted. So it was a terrible shock when the water supply was turned off. The rock was still there, no water. What do? You'll remember when we talked about the concept of the stick on Pesach, I think it was. We said that the stick was improvisation, was the concept of the difference between a man and an animal. If you get a monkey in here, and you ask them, oh, an animal, assuming an animal could talk, like Bilam's donkey over here. And you say to Bilam's donkey, get me out of Sefer from the top shelf, he'll answer you, I can't reach. That's what he'll say. Get even a little child, get me a Sefer from the top shelf, he'll look a moment and he'll take a chair and stand on the chair and he'll get it down. That's the difference between an animal and a human being. And a human being can improvise. When a human being has reached his limitations, he'll start using his imagination to overcome his limitations. He doesn't settle with limitations. The mate, the stick, represents that improvisation. It's the concept of stretching even further than your hand can stretch. A stick is an extension of your hand. It's using a tool, using your chokhmah, using your wisdom, to go as far as you possibly can and further. As far as you can go with your imagination and improvisation and everything. Use tools, use whatever you can to go far. And the concept of the miracle is that if that doesn't work, and you really need it, then relax, God will take over. And so the Jews are told, Moshe is told, at the splitting of the sea, by Yomer Hashem Moshe, God says to Moshe, Mati taka elai, what you're davening for? Daber el b'nei Yisrael b'yisau, let them walk into the sea. Says Rashi, what does Mati taka elai mean? La madnu, we learn from Yashaya, Moshe omer mitpalel, they're standing on the sea. And a similar situation is this, the Egyptians behind them, the sea in front of them. What do? You daven. So Moshe got into the El Moed as quickly as he could, and he started davening. Equivalent of Olam Moed. It was before the time of the Olam Moed. Omar Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, the Ribbono Shel Olam, Lo Eit Ata La'arich B'Tfilah. This is no time to daven. She Yisrael Netunim B'Tzorah. The Jews are in Tzorah and you're davening. I don't understand that. What else are you supposed to do when you're in trouble? You're told all over the place to turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that's what you do to get yourself out of trouble. So he's doing that. There's nothing else they can do. There's no Dunkirk, no little boats are turning up. The sea is there and they got across. So he's davening. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, a chutzpah, you're davening while the Jews are suffering. Tell them to walk into the sea. You haven't stretched out your hand yet. You haven't gone to the full extent of your limitations. When the water's up to here, we'll discuss the matter. And they walk until the water's up to there and then the sea splits. But no miracle before then, and davening doesn't help. That's the concept of Hanagami Sit. Hanagami Sit is when you've done all you humanly can and you still need salvation, God will do it miraculously. To them, to us, to you, to anybody. If you really need it for Avodas Hashem, if you really need it for the service of God, if you needed the house across the road to collapse, and you've done everything else you could to get it out of the way, and you couldn't, you could stand there, and when you, the moment after you'd finished your last effort, the house would collapse without you. It would work. But that's not Hanagatibit, that's not natural behavior. And the well is now nature. This portable rock is now Teva. So the Ribbono Shel Olam says to Moshe, take your stick, because the people have to realize that this is no less miraculous than the splitting of the sea. And the stick had come to represent miracles to the people. But don't use the stick. When it comes to Teva, when you don't have to create something new, it's just a matter of keeping it going. The difference between nature and miracles is that to split the Red Sea, you have to do something that has never been done before. It's difficult. Rain, the computer is programmed for rain, it's just got stuck. You just got to get it moving again. The computer is not programmed to split seas. When it comes to functioning within the world of nature, if the world of nature is not working the way it should, philo is what helps, davening is what helps. So Moshe Rabbeinu is told, take your stick and go to the rock. Give them a shear like they've never had before. Move them and let them daven. It's over to them. If they daven properly, the water will come. If they don't, let them starve until they daven properly. Don't stretch your stick out. Don't use your stick. Because when it comes to using nature, yes, and this is the incredible thing. What you have to do here is bring the Ribbono Shel Olam down into nature. If nature is not working, then it means that God has withdrawn himself from it. That's why it's got stuck. You've got to bring God back. The way we bring God back is with Torah and Tefillah, with learning and davening, is the way we bring God back into the world. So he says, that's what you've got to do. And when you're working on that basis of bringing God back into the world, then you don't have to extend yourself to your utmost. So it comes a question when you see people in business. And business isn't going well. Things are getting stuck like they shouldn't get stuck. We've had the seven fat years, and we're going through the seven thin years right now. What do people do? They stay up at night, and they calculate, and they call in their lawyers, and they call in their financial advisors, and they work, and they scheme, and they plan. And it doesn't help. If one were working with Hanagani Sit, it would help. If one were working on a miraculous basis, in other words, if the businessman was a tzaddik, and he needed his business for Avodas Hashem, it was clear that in order to fulfill his function in the world, the business had to survive. Then he would be expected to stay up all night and to do all he can, to use that stick, to use improvisation, to use his imagination, to achieve whatever he possibly can to solve the problem, and if he can't manage it, there'll be a miracle. He'll be saved by miracle. That's how it will work. But if one isn't on that level where you're absolutely sure that you need your business for Avodas Hashem, in other words, without your business, God is worse off. If you're not sure of that, then you've got to act al pi teva, you've got to use nature. And the method to use nature is tefillah, not work. As long as you're working well, as long as you're putting in the correct amount of time, and you're not doing anything stupid, and you're working honestly, and your business has the potential to function properly, that's all you have to do. The rest, the problem is in your davening, it's not in your efforts. And that's why I started off by saying it's terribly important to understand the difference between Hanagami Sit and Hanagati Vit, and to know on which one you're operating at any given moment, because it requires a totally different response from you. That's why when the Chofetz Chaim was asked by somebody whether he should see his business was going well and he wants to open another branch, Chofetz Chaim burst out laughing. And he says, what are you laughing at? He says, you know, it's crazy. It's like a guy has a samovar of water, and he comes to me and he says, you know, the water comes nicely out of the tap, I want more water, so I'll make another tap. That's not going to give you more water. Opening another branch is not going to give you more business. The Ribbono Shel Olam has decided you're going to earn so much a month. With one branch you learn it, with two branches you learn it. All the next branch gives you is extra Torah. That's a religious way of viewing business. That's a Torah way of viewing business. You're saying, look here, this is not a question of Hanagani Sit. If I was operating on the level of Hanagani Sit, where I require miracles, then before God steps in, he expects me to do everything within my power. So if I work out that I need another R1 million a year in order to operate in this world effectively, then the Ribbono Shel Olam would expect you to open branches and to work and to work and to work. And if that didn't help, he would step in at the last moment and he would put it on its feet. But if one isn't sure that one's operating on that level, it has to be hanagativit. And hanagativit is just letting things run, doing things as they should be done, not getting the sugar. And if things aren't working properly, it requires tefillah, it requires davening. And that's what God wanted to teach the Am Yisrael at this stage. When rain stops, it's exactly the same as when your portable well stops. And you won't have a Moshe to run to. And you won't have a magic stick to hit the clouds with. You're only going to have one tool, and that's tefillah. Start using it now. So Moshe starts giving his shiur, and part of his shiur is recorded in the Torah. Did you know that? It's the incredible thing about this midrash. Vayomer lahem, and he started telling them, Shimuna ha-moirim, you rebellious, miserable so-and-sos, I'm going to give you Musa like you've never had before. And I'm going to tell you that you're a bunch of nobodies, and I'm sick and tired of you, and that I'm not going to get you out of this hole, and that you're going to have to do it yourselves. I mean, I say, I dare not see like a mind. Do you think I can get water out of this rock? I can't. You do it. And then as he was saying that, and we don't record the continuation of the shir, but there might well have been a continuation, he hits the rock. Why does he hit the rock all of a sudden? That wasn't the plan. That's the trouble, that's the problem with Musa. You start to believe it. And he starts deriding him to the point that he believes that these people are incapable of getting the water out of the rock themselves. They're going to daven and the Ribbono Shel Olam isn't going to listen. Who are they? A bunch of rebellious nobodies. Are they going to get watered out? I have to do it myself again. And he hits with the stick. It has to be done with the efforts and with the energy of the supernatural. I have to bring in miracles, and before I can do miracles, I've got to extend myself, and I'm going to hit this thing, and it hits it once, and it hits it twice, and the water does come out. But says the Rabbi Mishlam, you've missed an opportunity for Kiddush Hashem. What is the concept of Kiddush Hashem? Kiddush Hashem is bringing God down into nature. And the whole idea of Tefillah was to bring God through davening back and to restart nature working again. The world is perfectly natural, this portable rock. That you didn't give that opportunity. You didn't have emunah. You didn't believe that I can work with Alpi Teva as well. Don't forget, for people in that generation, it was more difficult to conceive of God in nature than of God in miracles. We can't understand miracles. How does it happen? Splitting the Dead Sea, Mon, all that. Difficult for us to understand. For them, it was difficult to understand God in nature. And this would have been the important lesson, that you can have God in nature without the stick. You can be holding the stick and you don't need it. Tefillah, just by davening, you can get the wheels of nature turning again and it can save you. You don't have to get onto miracles at all. And that opportunity was missed by Moshe, because he got carried away with his own shoe. That's why most of the Chazal say that what he was punished for was deriding the people, although that was part of his function, and anger. He went so far in deriding them that he got angry with them and just didn't feel they were capable of pulling it off. And again he had to hit it. For that says the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, you can't come into Eretz Yisrael. What was the whole problem? Why were the other Jews banned from coming into Eretz Israel? Because they sent spies. Why did they send spies? Because they didn't have enough Avas Hashem, if you remember the shiur 2 weeks ago. What was this little episode for? Why does God decide to turn off the water? To start building up Avas Hashem. Who stops it? Moshe Rabbeinu. Misses the opportunity to rebuild their Ahava. So the Ribbono Shel Olam says, you also can't come into Israel. Because in Israel you have to work without your stick. And you, Moshe, are incapable of working without your stick. You don't know how to relate to me in nature. This was going to be the turning point. This was going to be the point at which you and Klal Yisrael started understanding that you've got to put your stick away, and Moshe Rabbeinu isn't going to be with you forever, and there's a way of handling things with tefillah, with davening, and through nature. And you, Moshe Rabbeinu, aren't capable of handling it, and nor are you, Aaron. Because you didn't stop it, you were party to the whole thing. Comes the question, but dealing with God on this level, let's understand what the difficulty was for Moshe and these people. What they are being asked to do is to bring God down into nature. To bring God down into nature. They were living far above the natural level. They weren't involved in nature at all, and that was their problem. Their philosophic difficulty, their intellectual difficulty, was the thought of bringing a God of Kedusha, a God of holiness and sanctity and this wonder of wonders and absolute of absolutes down into everyday nature. It didn't seem right. It seemed much more correct to do all you could and then say, God, I can't split the sea. I've tried, we've walked in the waters up to here, we've used the stick, we've done everything. You take over now. Rather that than bring God into one's day-to-day living. In other words, they could understand a method of earning a living. If we went to work, and we worked like anything, let's say in a year we had to raise 10,000 rand for ourselves. And we worked and worked and worked and it wasn't coming in. and we tried everything we could, and then we retired and said, Ribbono Shel Olam, we're not working anymore, you bring us the money. That they could understand. That means we handle the nature, this wicked, evil part of the material world we handle. If it doesn't work, God does it miraculously, but don't bring God down here. And the Rabbanit Rebbe, in fact, has a whole shiur where he talks about the change at Har Sinai, where the giving of the Torah enabled people to bring God down into nature. It gave them the mechanism which they did not have before. It was impossible before to bring God down into nature. After Har Sinai, it became possible to bring God down into nature. And there's a beautiful Rambam, in fact, as well. In the Sanhedrin, I think it is, where the Rambam talks about that as that too. That even those mitzvahs which were given before the Torah, like a bris milah, and there were many mitzvahs that were given before the Torah, one has to keep them after Matan Torah in a different way altogether. It's a different concept of keeping the mitzvah. Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, changed the whole attitude towards mitzvahs and the ability to handle mitzvahs. They could understand the pre-Matan Torah requirements. That is, they handle the physical world. If it doesn't work, God handles the rest. But to bring God down into day-to-day nature and say, God, I'm going to work today. It's purely natural that I should earn a living, but I know without you I can't. Please watch my business the whole day. Don't leave me for a moment. They couldn't understand relating to God in that way. I'm not feeling that well today. I'm going to a doctor, but I know the doctor doesn't have the ability to heal me. You have the ability to heal me. Please don't leave me for a moment. That concept, which is the way we relate to God today, was foreign to them. That's making God care about our day-to-day little problems, that's something they couldn't conceive of. And the Sedra starts with the teaching. Zot Chukat HaTorah, we're told at the beginning of the Parah Aduma, this is the principle of Torah. What? It goes on to Parah Aduma. This red cow must be perfectly red, and you burn it, and abracadabra, and you do this, and you can do that, and nobody understands a thing about it, and it can remove tumor. That's the principle of Torah. And the Mephoshim battle with it. Why doesn't it say Zot Chukat HaTumah? This is the principle of Tumah, of impurity, or of Tara, of purity. Zot Chukat HaTorah, this is the principle of Torah. What I want to suggest is this. The whole principle, the most amazing part of the Parah Adumah, is what is it for? It's Metaher Tomeim. If a person becomes Tomei, if a person becomes spiritually impure, through the Parah Adumah, it can remove his impurity. That's one of the reasons that we can't rebuild the Beis HaMikdash at the moment, and we can't walk onto the area of the Beis HaMikdash even. Because we are spiritually impure, we've come into contact with dead bodies, or with people who've come into contact with dead bodies, and so on and so forth, which gives us a certain status of impurity, in which state we are not permitted to walk on the place of the Beis HaMikdash, unless we have the Parah Adumah. If we have this famous red cow, if anybody ever finds one, they're going to make themselves a fortune. If we have such a cow, and the water is sprinkled over you, then you can walk onto the Beis HaMikdash. So it has the ability to change a person of tumor into a person of tahara. Something like a mikveh, but much more powerful than a mikveh. But the fellow who does it, the kohen who performs the act, becomes tomeh. He becomes spiritually impure. And that's the amazing anomaly of the Parah Adumah. Imagine if one said that, you know, if you, the person who fills the mikveh becomes tomeh, and the person who gets into the mikveh becomes tor. And if it has the power of making people clear, how can it make someone clear and unclear? And more difficult is that, okay, so let's accept that as an axiom. So that's what it is, one of these funny things. By dealing with it, you become tomeh. But the strange thing is, there's a chiyuv. The kohen has to do it. The Torah is mechayev. The Torah obligates the kohen to involve himself with this Parah Adumah. What's he involving himself? He's deliberately becoming tomeh. A man isn't allowed to do that. A kohen is not allowed to deliberately make himself tomeh. The kohen is not allowed to walk on a cemetery. If he did, then we're tetra, tetra, tetra. But he's not allowed to do it lechatchila. And here we've got a case where lechatchila, the kohen is told, you go and you burn the Parah Adumah, you mix the ashes with water, etc., etc., and through that you're going to become tomeh. Says the Torah, Zot Chukat HaTorah, that's a principle in Torah, that sometimes you have to do that. Provided the final sum total of the effect is tahara. What's being left in the world is a more pure world. If that involves you getting your hands dirty, sometimes you have to get your hands dirty too. And even the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to do it. The Kohen represents God on this world. The Kohen is the essence of spiritual purity. The one who keeps himself separate from the day-to-day activities of the world. Yet he's told, get your hands dirty with that Parah Adumah, even though it's going to make you tomeh. So don't you worry, Klal Yisrael, about, hey, how can you bring the Ribbono Shel'olam down into nature? He's going to get his hands dirty. It's not his business to worry about my day-to-day affairs. I'll worry about the material world, and if I can't manage, I'll call on him. No. The Ribbono Shel'olam is only too happy to get himself involved, in the same way as the Kohen is only too happy to get himself involved. Provided the final effect and the final result is Tahara. That's after you've called on God to get involved and to handle your day-to-day life. He's got to feel at the end of it that although he's, so to say, dirtied his hands, the final effect has been good. Which means not only have you made a couple of bucks today, but it's been worthwhile. God has to have a feeling at the end of it, ah, it was good. I've become Tomer, in a sense. I've involved myself in nonsense, but the result of it has been worthwhile, the result of it has been good. That was the lesson which the Ribbono Shel Olam tried to give to the people with the Pora Aduma, and tried to bring them to a level of having to shout out and battle for themselves in order to start developing a relationship with God, which they were lacking. He does it by turning off the water, and unfortunately Moshe, for whatever reason it is and on whatever level it was, misses the opportunity, and as a result of that he and Aaron both suffer. Any questions? Because miracles do work. If they've done everything he can on a physical basis, and they need the water, people are going to die of thirst. So that the miracles work, but that wasn't the way it was meant to be done. You can earn your living by miracle, but if you can do it naturally, it's better. Oh, sorry. Well, we wouldn't have been here today to have learned it, unfortunately. They probably would have killed Moshe at that point. He missed the point of that. He chose to operate on miracles, and he can't perform the miracles anymore. The whole idea was to move, that he was supposed in his shir, to move them to Tfilah. And he didn't. He missed the opportunity. He gave them another way out.
This period, the rabble, or the new generation.
They're not rabble, they were great people. But sure. The masses.
The masses that who came to them with the new generation, because it was 40 years. The
old most of the older generation.
Having died out in the 40 years, this was a new. Therefore, they had a chance to start all over again.
Yeah, but they were born into a situation of. They were born to spoiled kids.
They were born, yes.
They never had to work for themselves.
They had not gone through the concentration camp, right, or the suffering.
And nor had they had to struggle for anything in their lives. Whatever they wanted, they got.
They had taken for granted.
Right, that's why they now needed to be put into a situation where they had to start working for their own.
This is a new generation.
Yeah, yeah. Okay,
so the situation that you just mentioned about Moses and the rock, how does it relate to the
All I say is that the problem that the Jews had was, how can we involve God in the day-to-day activity? Right? Understand that?
Yeah, but we
just need to... Okay, the answer is that the same way as the Kohen is obliged to become Tomei, to become impure, right?
Yeah.
Which is not normally allowed, but for the sake of achieving purity, he's allowed to do that. So that's a chukah of the Torah, the principle of the Torah, which God binds himself by as well, and he's prepared and only too willing to get his hands dirty in the day-to-day affairs, provided the after effect and the result will be one of purity. That's what we do when we daven. That's what we do. What do we daven in Shmoneh Esrei? Refine and make us better. What does he care about us? In what way is the world going to be better if we're healthy? We're not going to make that much of a difference to the world, yet we have the chutzpah to say, Ribbono Shel Olam, drop what you're doing, please, and make me better. And Ribbono Shel Olam, if you look at the things you ask God for during the day, you begin to wonder, do you have the right? He's busy, he's got other things to do. The answer is yes, and he's only too happy, as long as he's left with something, as long as at the end of it he feels he's achieved something.
Yeah, but would you say why did Moses hit the rock? Because of his anger?
Because he felt that he was so carried away with his musa that he believed the Jews were incapable of achieving it by prayer.
In effect, he underestimated the
people. And that was his. A lot of the Chazal say, a lot of the Mefarshim say, that was his thing, and deriding, underestimating the people, not giving them the opportunity to rise to the occasion. Yeah. Does that answer your question about the love and the suffering? That it sometimes by creating a situation of suffering, in an extent, you bring out the love. What God is trying to do is to develop Ahava. And the way he's doing it is by cutting off their water. Because through that you've got to turn to him and pray and love him. And when he answers you, you start a relationship and you start loving him. But you've got to start the wheels moving. You've got to put the guy in the corner before you can develop that.
That's interesting because he talks about that, talks about that as well. That the first thing that when you got out was that some people turned really mental.
Bitter.
Yeah, bitter. And the first thing he was walking one day in the field or something. And the first thing he thought was a feeling of love or something. They just stopped, a lot of people didn't
tell him. What's the reason? The reason is because he ends his book with the fear of God. That means he must have been praying every day that the emotion should get him out. And when the emotion got him out, and he saw that he was still alive, there was a relationship already. A person who wasn't dead, and then when he got out finally, didn't help him establish any kind of relationship. And that's the mistake that Moshe did. He didn't give the Am Yisrael the opportunity of receiving water in answer to prayer.
It would seem that the way to do it is to get rid of the third stage, which Trevor mentioned, of lack of responsibility and lack of decision making, which would be the natural thing after that kind of situation, is to turn to bitterness. But if you choose to do something positive, you've got out of the third stage.
And your thing is to avoid the third stage. You can avoid the third stage by dozening. If in your second stage you would dozen, even then if you would dozen, you could avoid the third stage of not taking decisions, because you would understand.
Was the so-called rod, or the rod, if you use it as an image, was that unused by Moses?
The actual rod?
No, did the people not extend themselves?
They did. We're getting into the... You mean in this time, at the sea, for example, they walked in until they were up to their mouths. Each time they did something, so people did. Yeah.
They were in that way.
Yeah, but then they sat back and said, okay, Ribbono Shem, we come. And what the Ribbono Shem wanted...